Hello and welcome to In Her Corner, a podcast dedicated to celebrating and empowering women working at every level of sport on and off the field. I'm your host, Lisely Satali, and I'm absolutely excited to introduce today's guest because she's somebody I have often admired from afar and I'm sure has touched many of your lives with her great wins and lessons. It's the absolutely fantastic Michelle Moore, who is a leadership coach and author, as well as somebody who I think over the course of the next episode is going to take us on a wonderful journey of how she has used sport to empower and galvanize people around the world. Hi, Michelle. How are you? And welcome to In Her Corner.
Hi, Lizelle. The feeling is mutual. Much respect to you. Thank you so much for inviting me along. I'm really up for this and really excited to have this conversation with you. So thank you for allowing me to grace you with this wonderful conversation that we're about to have.
It's an absolute pleasure and it's a real gift for us to have you. So I want to just jump in by starting off by the beginning about your story with sport, and just to give a little bit of a flavor, because a lot of people might not know that you actually used to be a former athlete. And so I'm always interested when I get to have these conversations to ask, what was your sort of most memorable sporting moment, the one that really arrested you and made you fall unbelievably in love with sport?
Well, I was a 400 meter runner, and yeah, I started my athletics from the tender age of 9. I'm actually a twin, and so sometimes I talk in the plural. So we started at training in South London, and I just loved sport. It was the first place where I kind of felt really affirmed in my identity. I'm a black woman of mixed heritage and sort of lighter skinned. And being around other black and brown athletes was just hugely powerful for me. And it was just something that kind of really was a big part of my formative years and taught me many lessons. And one of the biggest memorable moments I had was when I was 15 years old and I was the London school's champion. I was very proud for the 400 meters.
Amazing.
I know, right? Yeah. And we were in Derby, so this is like a real countryside area of the UK, and we were there at the English schools where all the different boroughs and counties got together to compete against each other. And then if you made the finals and you were kind of like the top 8, the top 10 in the whole of the country, and you could potentially get an international vest. And I had ran in
my... This is big time.
For me, Lizelle, it was my Olympic Games, right? I was
100%.
In training, this, and it was just hugely exciting. I was away from home for the first time. I mean, the race dynamics was playing out because we were London. We had all of the black kids, black and brown kids, in majority of that team. And I'd got the same time as another athlete after I'd run my heat and my semi. And so I know it was incredibly exciting, but very scary at the same time. I had to do a race off at the end of the day, and it just went round the track, like round this meet, like wildfire. And everyone was so excited about this race off that it was just between myself and another athlete to see who would get into the final. And I was just beside myself with the fact that I'd got another opportunity and another chance, right? But I turned up for this race, and I'm telling you, when that gun went, I just went for it. But I was kind of going for it, but I was still, like, in my mind, I was just, the doubts were just there. And we were neck and neck all the way around this track. And I remember the London schools team just going crazy. They were all at the 200 meter mark and they were losing.
I love that.
Michelle. Yeah. And, you know, I had all those voices in my head as well. And literally in the last few strides, I'm just like running through treacle. I don't know if you know anything about athletics, Lizelle, but
yes, I do.
Lactic acid gets you, right? Whatever happens. Even if you're, you know, Grace Jackson, or even if you're just, you know, one of those amazing athletes, it will always come for you.
Always.
And so she passed me in the whoosh of air across my cheek. Oh. I was like 30 years later, crazy. And I lost that race and I was absolutely devastated. Mm. It was just one of those moments where I hadn't really stepped up for myself, and it taught me so much about the power of my mindset, about focus, about intentionality, about resilience. And it's a lesson that I learned, and I learned it harshly. And yeah. I've been into my professional career ever since. And for me, that's one of those key defining moments of my formative years and of sport. And I'm still a sportswoman. So once an athlete, always an athlete. I play netball. I'm injured now. I'm very, you know, physicality and physical activity is really important to me. I'm standing up as I talk to you. I may have to sit down halfway through because my hip because I'm a bit older now. But really, I know that I do my best speaking. I do my best thinking, standing up and being active. Yeah. So sport is I love it. I love to watch athletes. I'm inspired by the history of sport. And so being on this Her Corner podcast is amazing, talking about sport and leadership.
Awesome. And such great color. What I really love and I took from your experience there about reflecting on your most memorable sporting moment. Often when I've had guests come on here before and I've spoken to athletes, they always reflect on a big winning moment. And I find it so interesting that yours was this kind of anticlimax for that anticipation of a winning moment. But what I think is a really great learning from that is that you didn't let it like break you down. You instead like reflected on it and thought, actually, what are the points that I can take from this and make sure that I kind of use it to spring forward and do better next time. And I think it's something that sport teaches us so well at a very early age when you practice it, right? And I think sometimes when you don't have the benefit of playing sport from an early age, maybe that type of innate resilience isn't built. Have you seen a difference in that when you coach people at leadership level? Do you see that difference in them?
Absolutely. It gives you that head start, right? I always believed that my sports mindset was the actual attribute that defined my success in my life in so many ways, because I was a successful athlete, but I wasn't talented enough to actually fulfill my own Olympic dreams. But what happened as a consequence is when I would lose races, I would still turn up for training in the week, Lizelle, in the hope, in the potential that I had to win the following weekend, right? So it's this amazing lesson in picking yourself up, dusting yourself off, and just getting on with it. And that thing about how you translate that into your professional career in terms of resilience is that when you're working with a really good sports coach, and I've had the, you know, the real honor and privilege of working with some of this country's best coaches, is they're constantly giving you feedback. No, your arm should be in that position. We need hamstrings. We need, you know, that those micro details, right, that are the ones that give you your marginal gain, that difference between winning and losing, a thousandth of a second. And that's what created that very high performance mindset for me in my career, and has meant that I have actually kind of accelerated my career and the jobs that I have done because of that kind of marginal gains thinking. And you're right. Everybody wants to hear a winner's story. You know, everybody. And
everybody.
I'm a speaker, right? And I go around and I tell all kinds of stories. And every time I tell that one, which isn't hugely loads, but I do tell it, people expect me to say that I've won. One. Looking this up, you've got to be able to see that this is a loss. But no, everyone's like, what do you mean you didn't win? Did you say you lost? And I'm like, yes,
because we all love the Hollywood ending, Michelle. That's what we want. We want the escapism. We want the jump off point where, you know, you get the medal, you get everything. That's what we're looking for. That's what we want.
I know, but you know, life is full of those wins that are actually paradoxically our losses, right? That actually I only have the privilege now of looking back and being able to interpret those lessons. But at that time, I was devastated. At that time, I didn't have the consciousness to understand that, but sport was still giving me those gifts. And so unconsciously, I was becoming more resilient and developing that resilient mindset. And so it's only now that I'm able to really look back and think, I had a very high performance mindset of over-delivering that worked well in the main, but I know we're going to talk about this later, and it didn't work well in its entirety all of the time.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's definitely one I want to touch on, because in your new book, Real Wins, which I want to also to talk about later, you dive into that, and you dive into how it's almost this double-edged sword at times, particularly when you're occupying spaces where there isn't that sense of belonging and inclusion that's built around giving everyone the same opportunity to succeed, I think is here. And I just want to continue tracking back to your beginning there and what all those tools gave you. Your upbringing, you talk about that being an influence with, you know, being a twin, having athletics and sport as part of your DNA. Is that something you feel was super unique to your family, or is it something that you and your twin brought to the fore through your participation?
Well, I think for me, as a Black woman in the world, my experiences have been enriched and complicated by being Black and by being mixed, right? And so when my folks met, being a part of an interracial marriage meant that we had very specific experiences as a mixed family. And I remember from a really young age the abuse that my mum, my white mum, would get in the street for having brown babies. And I also remembered, like, my dad kind of instilling this sense of agency within us, even though sometimes it feels like, oh, well, there's this big chasm of whether or not, you know, you can make a difference. I always remember these boycotts in the 80s of the South African goods against apartheid. My dad was passionate that we didn't have a Barclays bank account because of their connections with South Africa. And I was like, what's he saying this? And we were like, I don't know, we was like 10. We were like 15, 16. Yeah. And actually it was that sense of, you have personal agency. You're make a difference. And so then when you overlaid that with sport and my kind of my identity and that sense of having these feelings of being excluded from, you know, being a minority in a white majority school, and then just the affirmation that I would get from my sport, but then being inspired by the likes of Tommy Smith and John Carlos from the 1968 Mexico Olympic Games. I've had their picture on my wall for like 30 odd years.
I love that.
The issues around equity and social justice and through sport became a way in which I was able to relate to myself and then to what was happening around me, you know, just in my communities and then globally. So that sport gave me that sense of identity to myself, but also to that broader global context of struggle around race. And so I was hugely inspired by that. And I've had the honor of actually interviewing Tommy Smith later in my career. And so therefore, you know, sport was just the kind of lens that showed us what was going on in terms of injustice. Yeah. Right.
It's a prism of social culture, right? Yes. And the injustices that come with it. And I wanted to talk to you actually about that, because I know a lot of the work you do is with athletes. And at this moment in time, we're in a very, I think it's a very powerful and galvanizing time, but also quite painful at the same time when you're living in an identity that's often marginalized by white society. Do you find that for a lot of athletes, when you talk to them, they find it difficult to speak up about that because of the potential backlash? Well, I shouldn't even say potential, because of the backlash that they get. And how is it that you instill that same sense of agency that your father, you know, really inspired you to be able to have, even from that young age, say you can make a choice and that choice can have a rippling effect on a wider position?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about kind of really recognizing your own individual attributes and traits and levels of consciousness around these issues of race and gender and how they all intersect, and homophobia, and what it is that you are comfortable doing. So a lot of the time when I work with athletes, it's about trying to support them in terms of their own self-leadership journey, right? So how we all have to understand ourselves within the world, whether that's the workplace, on the track, on the pitch, or in the boardroom. The more we understand ourselves, as Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist, talks about in that shadow self concept, you know, we're made up of those light and dark aspects. Yeah. But we tend to kind of repress those sides of our identities and personalities we really like, right?
Yeah.
And really, we have to get underneath those to be able to unleash our own self-awareness, but our own kind of leadership potential, and understand and recognize that we are more, if you're more comfortable calling out injustice, or actually you're more comfortable finding a different way to use your voice. And so in my book, Real Wins, I have a whole chapter on identity and activism. And this is about individuals tapping into what it is that they see as their role with it as a change maker. And a lot of the athletes in the aftermath of the racist killing of George Floyd were looked to for direction, or to make a comment, or to have some kind of role in the Black Lives Matter protest and the galvanization around issues to do with race and equity through sport. Some of these athletes are young. Some of these are 22-year-olds, 23-year-olds, and they're just developing their consciousness around race and issues to do with discrimination. And so it's really about understanding what it is that they bring. And I talk about this within a kind of a framework of being a positive disruptor or a weaver or somebody who's been is able to build collective identity, someone who can be a real visionary and someone else who might be an empathetic storyteller. And I talk about Simone Biles being one of those or a Naomi Osaka. So how yeah. can you channel your inner Raheem Sterling or Serena Williams? And that's yeah. the work that I do with athletes. And then I say to them, you don't have to do everything. You decide what you're comfortable with. You decide what aligns itself with your personality. And then you just rinse all of that out. Then you use your platform to do that. But it's you know, it is really difficult because there is a retribution that goes with any kind of speaking out. And we have to always make choices that keep us safe. So I'm always about keeping athletes and people in, as individuals as safe as possible. And what is it that they're comfortable kind of revealing and making a comment on, or how can they do that as a collective shared identity? And that's what's been very powerful about some of the movements that you've seen with footballers coming together and yeah. basketball players doing that. And absolutely. You know, consciousness and how it is raised and the activism in the US has had a knock-on effect in the UK, because our activism was kind of, you know, very, very small, because we would only need to look at the repercussions for somebody like Eniola Aluko when she yes. about the racism that she was experiencing as a professional footballer. And so therefore that sends a sign to many. They can be encouraged and inspired by it because of her courage and bravery, but at the same time it can be very off-putting because of, you know, the kinds of backlash that she received from the media and all kinds of different racist vitriol. That yeah. is something that makes a big difference to whether or not people want to use their voice and whether or not they get chosen for national teams. And so there's a lot to consider. So that pressure that goes with having a platform is, you know, very significant. So there's real power and strength in coming together and working as a collective, which you've yes. seen with some of the players now in the male football players under Gareth Southgate. And so there's a difference. And, you know, we only need to look at what happened with Marcus Rashford in really yeah. leading some of the activism and Raheem Sterling. But, you know, in the history of athlete activism in the UK, no athlete has been able to get a U-turn on government policy and feed yes. our most vulnerable and poorest families and make sure that they had food over the summer period of COVID. So, yeah. you know, I can talk forever about sports activism and the power of the athlete and those yeah. levels of consciousness and helping support them. But we are at a really important time. It is an awakening in lots of ways, and they have more power than they actually realise.
100%. Yeah, definitely. And I also want to sort of take a moment to talk a lot broader around people who work in and around sport and the athletes and the brands, because there's also a personal responsibility I feel like we all have. Yes, the athletes have the platforms, they have the social influence that, you know, being great at their sport affords them. But I also think sometimes, and I'm going to sort of put myself here in the firing line, I think those of us that work at big brands that shape perceptions and cultures in media to do with sport, we don't take enough ownership actually around being in that uncomfortable high risk position. And I just wanted to kind of dive in with you. When you work with leaders in those kind of businesses, what are some of the tools and some of the kind of learnings you've seen of maybe where they've not been able to go far enough to be able to have that level of social change and impact that you spoke to there in Marcus Rashford's example, and obviously a lot of other athletes over time? What are some of the lessons we can take from those athletes is what I'm asking, in our everyday, that can enable us collectively as an industry to have that level of impact that we need to have to move things forward?
I think it comes down to that self-awareness piece and understanding your very specific context, right? I have stopped doing EDI. I've stopped a long time ago doing like EDI straight talks, because I actually don't believe they make the difference that they could and should. And so we have a lot of organisations who do much the same as like performative action, right? We've done some unconscious bias training. We've had this person in to deliver EDI. We've done it. We've ticked it off. And then actually, we've ran, you know, a number of interventions and initiatives. And fundamentally, these projects, these interventions are not making the step change that we need. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in today. And that's because we have to get underneath the skin of this issue. And one of the ways in which we do that is people taking individual personal responsibility. And change only happens when it is personal, when it's irresistibly your job to do it, right? And you are intentional about it. Because what you often hear is, oh, it's the culture, it's going to take time, changing people's attitudes, well, you know, it's going to take years and years. And I'm like, I'm impatient for change. One of the reasons I wrote the book is
I love that.
And I actually don't believe that has to be the case, because I've worked with leaders and I've worked with people who are prepared, white conscious leaders, who are prepared to hold up their hands and say, look, I don't understand this, right? I trust you, Michelle. You help guide us through this. And we've done that through direct one-to-one coaching, where they have looked at it like another area of their business to say, right, what would I do if I was overhauling my brand management? Well, I would identify the expertise. If it wasn't in-house, I would buy it in. I would look at training and development for my whole team. I would make sure that it is built into performance reviews. I would allocate budget. And it just goes on in terms of the quality assurance. And I start from that premise. And then often when we are looking at how we unpick every bit of that ecosystem, because the decision that you make around your HR practices will relate to your representation on your boards and how you recruit, and all of those things are interrelated. But what we often have is one project over here, one project over there that doesn't strategically link together. And we have maybe a leader that really does get it, but the person, the middle manager, doesn't, and actually undermines and unpicks some of that work when it gets down to that operational level. And so fundamentally, a shift in that is, I believe, through one-to-one coaching, group coaching, expertise that's brought in that looks at inclusive leadership, that looks at leadership. And it's not this EDI piece, that it's leadership that is cross-sector, that is the excellent leadership is excellent work around anti-racism, anti-homophobia. It crosses all of those divides. And so I think that the people that are scared or don't want to get it wrong, and you know, oh, it's this idea of being that there's a fear that has created the issues that we see today. And so it takes those people to step up and say, I've got to do this differently, and to get comfortable having that uncomfortable conversation. And I think that one of the ways in which you do that is by being very intentional about the people that you work with and how you work with them, but actually getting really comfortable with, you know, some of your individual organizational shame around this, because that's a part of it. You know, actually just acknowledge it, deal with that. And then we're able to then move on from a different space entirely. And, you know, it's not straightforward. But once you start to get involved with this through the action, and you might not understand the whole of the action, but you understand the people and you respect and trust the people that are telling you to do it.
100%.
Your attitude comes afterwards. I was doing a talk the other day, and they employed me to, you know, asked me to do an anti-racism talk, and I did. And then they were like, you know, last 20 seconds, Michelle, I want you to give your three top tips to everybody. And I said, like, you know,
three top tips about ending anti-racism. Wow.
All out. And I was like, you know what I'm like. Like, I'm very straight. I'm never going to give you that clear answer, because actually, until you go on the journey, you have answers for your individual context. And this is the thing. People just want this tick box, and I'm not going to give them the tick box, because you've got to go on the journey and you've got to start making some of those strides, because the culture of any organisation, and we're seeing it now play out in all kinds of sports in the UK, is actually upheld by people who are a part of that system, who want to protect their own privilege and their own power within those constructs of white supremacy. And that culture is determined by the worst behaviours that they're prepared to accept. We're seeing it in the police at the moment. And so therefore, unless you want to take responsibility for that culture as an individual, then we can't move forward in terms of change. And everybody can do something in their own individual context. I believe that because I've seen it and I know it works.
Yeah, no, that's such a great point, because I always say to people, you know, the baseline of the worst behavior that you tolerate actually defines the culture in a place, and particularly the culture in an organization and the type of people you want and the type of values you want to imbue. So unless you root that out and you use that as you basically your benchmark to say the worst behavior, we have to assume is the way we're showing up, and we have to own why we need to fix that, because just ignoring it won't do it. And I thought what you said there was really interesting around organizational shame, because I do think that there is a moment in the sports industry where some organizations, but also outside, I think I see this across a lot of companies, where they was kind of a big, almost cathartic response to George Floyd's murder and the much more visible, loud conversations, at least here in the UK, around tackling racial inequality and also other forms of inequality. And one of the things that kind of has stood out to me really as a result of it is there was all this fever of activity when it first happened, sort of your knee-jerk reaction, I'm going to call it. And then after that, there's kind of been this, like, we couldn't keep that momentum up, because we didn't go on the journey to actually understand why this was of value and important for us to stand up against and make right. And now we're ashamed because it's actually showing that it's actually not been a priority for us. We reacted to it because the expected behavior is that we should be outraged, but we actually within our own psyche haven't got there. And so one of the things I kind of wanted to dig a little deeper to say is that self-awareness piece is quite difficult, because I actually have the belief that depending where you come from and your different culture nuances, for a really long time at top levels in organizations and just generally in society, we've seen leadership as this infallible thing, the quality that you have, that you're a good leader because you don't fail, you don't make mistakes, and you don't have flaws. But I actually think there's something about actually challenging and redefining what good leadership looks like that can help us unlock some of these barriers.
Absolutely. Lizelle, you're brilliant. You're my favorite podcast interviewer so much already today.
Oh, thank you. You do a lot of these, so I'm really proud. I know you do a lot of these, so I'm grateful for that compliment.
Absolutely. You know, I really think that we need to rethink leadership. And in my book, Real Wins, we talk about leadership from that viewpoint of conscious leadership, to take away the hyper-masculinity that goes with such hierarchical, traditional kind of forms of leadership. I take it from one of my role models, Angela Davis, when she talks about how we can all be more leaderful, right? So how is it that we become so conscious of our own self-awareness and how we relate to others, in the sense of, if we can really relate well to ourselves, then there's greater relational connection with other people, so that we're enabled to turn up more authentic, more accountable to ourselves, and then we can hold other people to account, have greater empathy and integrity to our leadership style. And then everybody can be filled up with their own leader full potential in all kinds of ways, because it's not until we really give to ourselves, in a way that we can be self-compassionate, that we can then give that to somebody else and then enable ourselves to kind of stand in somebody else's shoes and demonstrate that empathy. And we've just seen it over how governments have responded to COVID-19 globally. You know, there's some research that shows us that the more conscious, empathetic leaders have been female leaders that have had the most success.
Jacinda Ardern. Jacinda Ardern. New Zealand, like such a great case study example, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And so when we understand that a different kind of leadership model is needed, where everybody can take some responsibility, that this is distributed leadership, and that we're all interconnected. I'm coaching you know, young emerging leaders at the moment. And I'm saying to them, you know, what is your leadership style based on? And they're like, well, my previous leader did this. And I'm like, stop, right? Let's look at what your values are. What's important to you? What kind of leader do you want to be? What do you want people to think, feel, and do when they are around you? How do you want this to be collaborative? Or do you want it to be collaborative? And they're like, well, of course. I'm like, well, very small things. You can have a role in chair. You know, there are all these small but mighty actions that you can do in your day-to-day that demonstrates how you can be a leader. And I have this thing about a State of the Nation address. I love a State of the Nation address. You can tell.
Yeah, because I'm a speaker. Yeah. So go ahead and let's dive into it then. We want one. We've never had one on In Her Corner, so I'm excited for this.
Oh, I'm not going to do one now, Lizelle. That's
Okay, another time. We'll have to get you booked for celebration and get everyone around. We'll see.
It may come. You know, I'm like an authentic ad libber. Yeah. But I get the people that I'm working with to be able to demonstrate their values through their actions, right? There's no point in being committed to social justice or being of service or being compassionate if you can't act that out. You're telling me those words, right? Let me see them. What actions have you done this week that have actually demonstrated that you're committed to your own well-being and to social justice, for example? And you can use every opportunity, how you open a meeting, how you close a meeting, to convey your passion and your commitment to that, but also show an action towards it in some of the work that you may have done. A very small thing, you know, senior leaders go to meetings, right? They have these discussions, right? And one of the things that they then do is they're, well, I've had those discussions at that senior level and I'm going to get on with my work. And they sometimes forget about the people that they're working with who they're managing. Can you feed back and talk about how you may have communicated something in a particular way and it didn't land very well? And actually the next time you're going to do that, you might adapt your communication skills, or you might follow up in a different way, or you might have a pre-conversation. So it's really understanding how you can get the best out of yourself as well as others. And that sharing of that experience makes a big difference. I always remember when I worked in local government and I spoke openly about the discrimination that I was experiencing, people thought, how could somebody of that seniority be experiencing that kind of oppression? And I was like, what are you talking about? Look at Serena Williams. You know, I always use sport as my prison. It doesn't matter how important, how successful you are, I am still going to earn less money than my white counterpart, even though I'm doing more work, even though I'm more highly qualified. Yeah. But there was something about the sharing of being really authentic and real. And I think leaders don't do enough of that. They don't embrace their vulnerabilities enough.
Yes, 100%.
And I think that means that when I embrace my vulnerabilities and I actually share some of those, it's safe for me to do so, right? And yes. Often talk to people about what that safety looks like.
That psychological safety is like, yeah, right? Because that's often what people are really, really leaning into when they don't want to show the vulnerability. But I think I always say to people, one of the powerful quotes I always remember, and you reference her really well in your book, Real Wins with Brené Brown, and she talks about how vulnerability should be thought about as like seeing to be showing up and being seen for showing up as yourself. And in that moment when you can't quite be perfect, but people see your humanity. And I think that's all people need to sort of learn to free up, you know, their way of communicating.
I mean, Brené has an advantage because she's a white woman, let's be clear.
And that is something that I think a lot of people also forget in the journey. At which point can you really show up as your full self and be seen? You know, I'm a Black woman who works in a predominantly white company in an industry that is sports media that has typically not held the gate open for me. So how I can show up as my full self and show my vulnerability is always going to be far less than my white male counter. But one thing that I always say to people, even my act of showing up is some form of resistance against a system that has largely kept me out. And so you think to yourself, when you're in that leadership position, at least the consciousness I try to have, and this is from having listened to various talks you've given and read, is always I say to myself, what would the Lisselli who was 21 years old, who didn't have the benefit of having me in a leadership position in this, want to see? What kind of leadership behavior should I model that will help her in that moment to see herself in the best way she can in that moment. That's kind of my little kind of self-talk to myself. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's brilliant, because absolutely it's like, you know, forward thinking, but then at the same time, backward gazing, right? You know, how do you actually really apply those lessons that you learn? And that's the beautiful thing about being an author now, that I'm able to look back on some of my experiences and some of those harshest experiences that go with loss, that go with exclusion, that go with life, from grief to, you know, being redundant, all of those things. Then you're able to kind of apply a different mindset to it and then transform your future, but at the same time give that insight and give those lessons to others to be able to benefit from it. And so we need you in that position, Nisselle, because you're creating these opportunities and these spaces and these narratives to have the opportunity to redefine them, to construct them differently, to enable pathway to be opened up for young Black and brown women that look like you to get into your position, you know, is priceless.
Yeah, that's the dream. That is the dream. So,
We're already doing it partly, right?
Exactly. We're living the dream. We're living the dream and walking in the purpose. And one of the things I want to sort of lean into now with you, I think, is just to reflect a little bit on your own learnings. And I want to sort of delve into some of the ones that, you know, you touched on in your book, to give people a preview. To everybody listening, go and get Real Wins, whether you want to listen to it, because Michelle's got a beautiful voice, as you can tell, and is a fantastic storyteller. I have had the pleasure of listening to you on my walks to and from work for the last month, which has been wonderful for me. So thank you. You've been I've had your leadership coaching every day as I've been going to work. So I was going to say to people, go and do that. You couldn't ask for a better leadership coach to and from your day to day. And also read the physical book as well, if you're a bit more old school, which I actually usually was actually, but now I've grown a love for Audible. So thank you for making it available on both. But I want to just lean into a couple of lessons there that you talked through, and just to see how they've shaped and defined your own life and your own leadership style. Because I think it's always interesting to hear that kind of personal lens. And one of the lessons that kind of stood out to me from when you were talking through, and I've picked a couple of examples just because they talk to me in different ways, was the example that you gave where you were working in a setting and the character's name that you renamed him was Kevin. So let's talk about Kevin. There's a book title in there, I think, actually. And so you reaccount this incident where you're in a room and there is this unseeing of you and your identity. Hyper-invisibility is, I believe, the term that it's called, where you are both acknowledged and not acknowledged in your presence as a Black person in a space that is predominantly white. And he made a racist slur and racial tropes. And you asked him and challenged him quite clearly on that. And then what unfolded afterwards was quite a painful thing. But I loved how you turned it in the book, and you termed it one of the most painful but dignifying wins you've had. And I just wanted to delve into that a little bit to understand, how did that shape your perceptions going forward after you had that experience?
It's such an interesting example that you pull out, because it was one of those examples that I wasn't sure whether or not I wanted to include it, but actually it was some of my better writing and kind of connecting to the story of how 100%. We can all identify with being oppressed, whether it's to do with race, whether it's to do with our sexuality, whether it's to do with religion. And so I was trying to pull out those areas where we feel excluded. And there's a particular paragraph that's just come to me as you're talking.
Right. Go for it.
Might just, if it, you want me to read it, I could
I
read it.
I would love you to read it. I had it myself. So that's brilliant that you've got it. So please go ahead.
The system had won. It had beaten me down. In truth, it wasn't even that one event. It was a lifetime of rejection. Sly, subtle digs, negative racial assumptions, lower pay, the code switching, you name it. That's what oppression does. It creeps around your edges, slaps you firmly in the face, and then unforgivingly repeats the cycle.
Yeah. And I think it was that repeats the cycle that really touched me. I actually remember I was walking and I stood still in the road and I played it back. And it was kind of like an irony that I think Shakespeare and other writers like you would appreciate that I was repeating the painful cycle that you were talking about, because it just slapped me in the face. And I think when you describe that moment where you quietly stood up, how do you create that level of strength in yourself to get that level of real resilience and dignity in the face of oppression?
You know, I always think in those moments, which at the time, you know that they're a key moment, there's something about them, but you can't necessarily put your finger on them because you're in the mire of this kind of maelstrom of this, like these, all these conflicting emotions. And I don't know about you, Lucelli, but we are beautifully made Black women, right? And I am very in touch with what that means to me. And my paternal gran came here from Guyana in the 50s with, you know, one suitcase and a couple of children. And my dad was one of those. So I often think about when I'm in those moments, even if it's not consciously, she's always with me.
Yes. And
if she has gone through all the kinds of the weight that she has experienced, and I'm in this position of privilege where I actually get to use my own agency. And in those moments, I may have, you know, lost. It looks like I've lost on paper, right? But what it did for me is it reminded me of the strength of those that have come before. That actually, even though these people on paper have won, the knowing look that I'm giving them, the look that says, often when we don't have to say anything, but it's a look that says, I know that you know that I know that you're wrong, and you know it as well in this moment. And there's power in that, you know. And I call that chapter Standing Tall. And I'm a 6'1" woman, right? And I am proud of my height. And in that moment, I drew myself up to that height. Yeah. And so, yes, it feels like at times the system kind of can beat us down, but we can still defeat it if we choose to be undefeated. And I chose to be undefeated because I was like, this is not going to beat me, even though they know, right? And so there's something deep down inside of me in terms of my resilience, because I'm leaning on the history of before that moment. And yet to take the power to create documentation, to create policy and protocol, so it can't happen again in the same way. So I feel as if I've made my change in the way that I can, that I get to define it. And that's about me standing tall and tapping into my power and my agency. And I'm able to move on from that in a different way. But the catharsis goes with kind of, you know, really understanding all those moments that happen to us. And sometimes you have to choose not to respond. That is the response. I could have been in all kind of, you know, conflict, but I chose not to. I chose not to do that. I chose to be able to transform this for myself and therefore others. And I think we're all in those positions sometimes where we have to ask ourselves, what's the cost? Who is there, somebody else that can take this on? How can I use my influence in a different way? And we can still be empowered. We can still be empowered, and we don't have to do the shoulda, woulda, couldas, because we can still find power in our fellowship, in our community with others, in creating that space. I talk about this in the book where we can share our identities across divides. And Afua Hirsch, amazing writer, author, all around brilliant cultural commentator, incredible woman, talks about when she met Oprah Winfrey. Oprah Winfrey gave her some advice, and it was a funny story because I was going to a talk to hear Afua Hirsch and David Olusoga, the great David Olusoga, in conversation to talk about David's book, Black British, and Afua's book. And Afua was like late, like by 45 minutes, and everyone was like, what's going on? And she bowls in. And she's got this incredible energy, and she's like, look, I'm late, and I don't even care that I'm late, everyone. And everyone's like, what's going on? And she said, I've been with Oprah Winfrey at the premiere of this Disney movie. And she said, I've asked her a question. I've come to share it with everybody here. And everyone was just like, what's this question? And basically the question was, how do we survive? How do we learn to thrive? How do we cope with the intersections of oppression that we're experiencing when it just feels insurmountable? And Oprah talked about resilience. Oprah talked about being spiritually ribbed. How can you be spiritually ribbed? How can you create spaces where you bounce back, but you're also transformed in bouncing forward in terms of your resilience? And that's the bit that I've put on there. That's the spin I've given it. Because spiritually ribbed to me is about having a really deep understanding of yourself, but also being really in touch with your radical self-care that enables you to show up today. I'm enabled to show up today with you, Lizelle, because I've been able to look after myself in those small daily practices that make me feel more of me in the world. But they're a part of our radical self-care as those of us who are from marginalized identities. They become these acts of our self-care is like Audre Lorde talks about our preservation. They're actually a political act of warfare because we need them to not just survive, but to find opportunities to thrive and slay and write books like Real Wins, because this is my definition of success. No, I'm not a traditional CEO. No, I'm not a traditional leader, but I have my agency and power to define my success for myself outside of societal norms, outside of those conventions. And to me, that's joy. To me, that's being spiritually ribbed. To me, that's me aligning my purpose and being of service with my expertise so that I can show up and be of service to others so that they can individually transform themselves and then transform their communities. That's the highest, fullest expression that I can be in the world. And that's the bit that where I have the most impact. And figuring that out at 48, 49 years of age is like gold dust to me.
So yeah, now we've reached the segment of the podcast that I love the most. I kind of call this my personal masterclasses in life lessons from women I admire. And we're just going to sort of take a deep dive now, Michelle, into sort of pivotal moments that we've obviously spoken about throughout this episode, but moments that have truly defined who you are, what has informed your worldview and your approach to your work. And in no particular order, I always think like a top three is always a good way for people to lean in and focus into this section. So we want, you know, both, we want highs and we also want ones that have been sort of reset moments to get you to launch forward for those real wins.
Wow, that's a big question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think the thing about having written a book, Lizelle, is that when you have had the luxury actually to look back over your life and then apply some kind of intellect to it, now that you've kind of lived a bit of a life and, you know, approaching 50, I have had many moments where I have made just so many magnificent mistakes, right? And when you look back and you think about what are those defining times that make this big, grandiose, almost impact on you. And often you can't really put a finger on them. You know that they are a succession of lessons that you might not get the first time, right? And those can often come out of some of the really tough moments. I think I mentioned when my team said, Michelle, we didn't like your leadership style. We really found you very demanding and your high standards were standards that not everybody could live up to, right?
Yeah.
And something about me had to understand that actually there was some truth to that. So my shadow self in those parts of your identity that you want to repress was actually not helping me in that moment. And I had to be big enough, you know, to really accept that feedback and criticism. It wasn't.
Yeah.
So I had to be a very, very open-minded, conscious leader and recognize that there were some parts of me that I needed to be able to develop and needed to become much more distributed in my leadership style, enabling others to be able to make their difference and finding ways to really empower people to live more fully into their potential, and that leadership is best when it is shared, and that the journey in our lives and those defining moments are all about how self-aware are we, how conscious are we of our actions, of our beliefs, of the unintended consequences.
Yeah.
What are we going to do about it? Are we prepared to take that radical responsibility Because that's really hard. That's no joke. You know, that's your lifetime's work. And I've just written about a small amount of it in my book, Real Wins. So when I look back and think, what are those defining moments? They come out of some of my toughest challenges when I experienced personal grief. And as a consequence of that, I became a much more compassionate individual, a much more compassionate leader, in touch with those emotions that gave me perspective around my life, gave me perspective around the challenges and the priorities, and actually being able to say, I'm not defined by this role. I'm really inspired by the work that I do that transforms communities, that transforms people and their lives in all kinds of ways when you help support them with their mindset shifts. But my life is defined by the values, by the quality of my relationship, by how I can create that greater relational connection with others. And that, to me, is what's important. And being able to challenge myself, to back myself when things are difficult. You know, we have to often start before we're ready. And that's a lesson that I've learned throughout my years, that you're never going to have everything, you know, all lined up perfectly. But actually, having the commitment and motivation to challenge yourself, to take yourself out of that comfort zone, to take on that new challenge, even though you're not as confident as you'd like to be, it's holding the tensions of that fear and anxiety and self-doubt and still choosing to move forward. So thinking about those defining moments, my menopausal brain can't recollect all of those. But what I can say is that through those magnificent mistakes, I have been fortunate enough to be able to develop the systemic resilience in me. So in those challenging times when I had personal setbacks, I was able to get through them, right? And then when I look back, I'm like, that resilience in me was, we develop our coping strategies by life's challenges, right? And we're doing them out of awareness sometimes. And sometimes we just, you know, we didn't realize that actually our systemic resilience reveals to us the strengths that we didn't even know that we had. And that, for me, is what you then take forward to transform your future in all kinds of ways.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that moment that you're talking about there, having that, first of all, humility and introspection is such an important thing, right, in order to be able to fully get where the other person's coming from, even if your actions and your words and the way in which you're carrying yourself did never ever were intended to be received that way. What are some of the things that you found effective for helping people catch themselves? Because we all have this moment where when you get feedback, especially on something that feels so personal, like your leadership style, like the way in which you want to interact or build or motivate people, it can be quite soul crushing to receive that feedback. So what are some of the effective ways you've learned over time to kind of remove that feeling of it being super like, it's about me and me not being good enough or me not being liked, and so that you can kind of take that step back to say, okay, really hear what they're saying and how can I address it in a way that doesn't remove the emotion, but let's say doesn't let the ego of the emotion override your ability to lean into what people are trying to, you know, get out of the experience of working together on leadership.
I know, it's easier said than done, right, Lizelle?
Always. I'm asking for me because it can be really challenging, especially when you're leading a big team and you're new in work environments, which often I think, personally speaking, as a Black woman working in sports environments, I'm often leading teams of people who look very different to me and have very different lived experiences. And so that way of communicating as well can be misconceived in those moments. But what I've found helpful over time has been, how can I lean back, hear what they're saying, and try to find a common ground to facilitate my working and leadership style with the way in which they need to meet my way and my lived experience too. So just if there's some useful techniques, because it can be really hard, I think, sometimes when you are one of few, especially in a leadership position.
Absolutely. And I think that's a perfect answer to your question, Lizelle. But the way in which I look at this is, is all about how you respond rather than react, right? So our levels of self-awareness have to kick in. And the more conscious we are as of our leadership decisions and actions, the more in tune we can become with that. Because the more in tune we are with ourselves, the more in tune that we can be with others and the world around us, right? And so when you are in those situations, it's often about kind of just disrupting that negative self-talk, that inner self-critic, your inner saboteur, and recognizing that this is that moment when I could actually give in to my emotions almost. And I talk about this quite a lot. I was coaching somebody today, actually, and we were talking about how athletes regulate their emotions. And then what I'm talking about is how you can distance yourself from your emotions. And athletes do it all the time. You know, they're in the Olympic final. They could let all of the nerves get to them.
Yeah.
But what they've done is they have time and time again rehearsed those moments where they recognize what's happening is actually just a reaction to the situation.
Yeah.
Nerves, my body's temperature going up, my and we all get this when we're under pressure.
Totally. I was about to say it's the pressure factor. Yeah. And it stops you being able to have that moment of pause that you need in actually to collect your thoughts, right?
Your body, you're embodied, your body gives you the signs. You know, your heartbeat gets a little bit faster. And so as soon as your body gives you those signs, your mindset has to take over. And this is what athletes are really good at, because they're like, well, I have trained for this moment. Everything is geared up for this moment. I cannot let that fear dictate that moment, because actually right now my abilities, my skills, my talents is what I'm known for. It is what will get me through the execution of this moment. And so for us as everyday extraordinary people, we have the choice to for our self-awareness to kick in and to understand that we have to disrupt that pattern. And I do a counting technique, because 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 actually disrupts that patterning. And I add something positive. You've got this, you can handle this. What's the worst that can happen? Understand what's happening in that moment. My self-awareness kicks in where I'm able to respond. And sometimes people have other cues. They do that. They might take their glasses on and off. They might readjust their body position. What you're trying to do is give yourself time to respond rather than to react. And it's then from that point of view where you might invite more, tell me more, let me understand. And if you are under threat, you don't know how to respond, I often do, let me get back to you on that. I hear what you said. You know, and so it's about how you then process that information in a way that's going to be supportive to what's being, you know, expressed to you. But at the same time, you have to give yourself time to kind of get on, get understand it. But we have to process and honor what was happening to us. And when I received that negative feedback, I've received negative feedback on a number of occasions. I remember, you know, hearing it, parking it and saying I was going to get back to them, and I had to leave. I had to honor my emotions at that because I was upset, and I had to honor that. My dad gives great advice. I called him up and he was like, Michelle, go back in there and front everything up. And I was like, I said, okay. I put the phone down and promptly did the opposite. And he usually gives advice, but on that time I had to honor how I was feeling. I couldn't get past it. And I came back the next day, you know, like the Klitschko Anthony Joshua fight. I was ready, you know, and I dealt with it. I listened to understand, not to respond in that moment, because I knew that I had to do a lot of listening and then being able to process that and align that with where I was in terms of my own personal growth. And so there are those tools that can get us to disrupt our patterning and our scripts that we tell ourselves, and being self-compassionate. You know, when we show compassion for ourselves, we're able to do that to others. We're doing the best that we can, mostly. Most people are doing the best they can with the tools they have. And so when I kind of reflect on that, that's what then helps me to move to the next right action.
No, definitely. It's a there's a very famous saying, you know, if I was them, I would do exactly the same thing, because you're operating from the point of view that you have the same amount of information, the same level of assumption, the same perspective. So to assume they would think otherwise is often sometimes where we get into that embattlement, rather than taking that step back to listen. So that's super helpful. And in terms of when you're looking ahead now, obviously having written a great book like Great Wins, and thinking about the lessons you've passed there, and I love the way you've weaved in your personal and your professional, and also that anchor as a huge sports fan of how your early life career as an athlete really helped you. Are there particular sort of highlights that you look back on and you say, I'm really, really proud of this moment because it really set me up for with the lessons I've been able to give other people as a springboard for their own success?
Oh, wow. I mean, I'm somebody that's not like conventional. I exist out of the, on the margins, and that's where I thrive, right? So I'm not somebody that kind of fits into those kind of stereotyped often, but conventional ways of everybody, how they exist, if you like. So I always find those questions a bit of a challenge. And for me, it's about how success is shared, you know. So success and joy and achievements don't really mean much if they're not shared. And I've been very fortunate that I have been recognized in my career for, you know, some accolades. I've won some awards. And you know, people think, oh, are those the main are those the main moments? Are those the pinnacles? And I would say that, you know, they're visible moments, right?
Yeah, they're highlights, but they're not the one. Yeah.
No, but what I do like about them is that when I won a particular award some time ago now in 2016, it was the Precious Award for Outstanding Woman of Colour. I was stunned to win it because I do a lot of work that's unseen, that's behind the world of sport. And I was up against some athletes, international athletes, and I was like, there's no way I'm winning that award. And I did. And it had such a massive impact on the people in my community, and especially young Black women who could see themselves through some of the work that I did and could relate to me. And they honestly felt as if they had won an award. I overheard a conversation between two of them who were like, they were competing as to if I was one of their mentors. And I hadn't mentored either of them, but like...
I love that.
I know, but the work that I do is to try and make people feel as if I am mentoring them, actually.
Yeah.
By just some of the work that I share and being open to supporting people in all kinds of small but very mighty ways in terms of the impact that that may have. So, you know, there are those moments of accolade and achievement. But for me, it's more about when people convey to me the work, that the impact of some of the work that it's had on them in terms of creating mindset shifts, of how when you powerfully show up for somebody and you have more, they can lean on your confidence. So sometimes people can't see their potential. But you can see their potential, right? And conveying that and communicating that to them to say, look, I think you should go for that job. I want you to back yourself. Send that pitch. Self-advocate. You're not being confrontational. You're self-advocating for yourself in that space. Nobody's doing it for you. And to have somebody kind of on your shoulder saying that to you kind of gives you that lift.
Yes.
I have been very fortunate to be, it's a privilege to share space with people and to be their coach and to witness them going for the gold, if you like.
Yeah.
That can be the difficult conversation with the boss, the tricky negotiation with the teenager in your life, the job promotion, the examination, and just having the conversation with the man or the woman that you got a crush on, whatever it is.
Yeah,
it's like backing yourself in that moment. And then when I get the honor of them kind of giving me the update on our next coaching session, I'm like, that's amazing. Because the results speak for themselves. And you know, I'm very fortunate to be able to share that space with people, and it's really, it's a real honor to do that. So I get my joy by, you know, those moments which create can be catalytic in all kinds of ways for people. And it can be that catalyst for change in people's lives that can be small, but yet have extraordinary results.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think just to that point, I don't think I've ever told you this, but I'm going to say it because I think it's so important to reflect on it with you, if I may. Seeing you be so visibly unconventional and owning that level of individuality and using it to pull people forward was such a great thing for me to see from afar. And it's something that I've always admired about you, and why I got really excited when I saw your book was available. And then obviously you say very kindly agreed to come on the podcast, because I feel was like a culmination of moments in my life that I always hoped I would meet you at this point, when I could recognize how much seeing you visibly owning spaces, challenging them, being able to help other people and hearing the great impact you've had on them definitely gave me a huge amount of lift in moments in my journey in sport and in working in the UK. So I just want to say a big thank you for having that level of intentional generosity to create that space and the platforms for people, because the ripple effect isn't just the people you're sharing the rooms with. It's what we're those like me on the outside who have the pleasure of meeting those people, hearing about them, then having all the work and the things that you're rightfully recognized and celebrated for come together as one. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Lizelle. That's so touching, because it does make a massive difference to hear that. And we're all kind of busy people getting on with our lives. And sometimes we don't take that moment to acknowledge and to actually tell some of those people who we respect and admire that stuff, that how important that their work is to us, even if we're not directly working with them. So that's really, really lovely. Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, that visibility piece that I try to talk to people about a lot. You know, when you show up for yourselves, the impact that has on others, can be huge. And even, you know, like people that, if you're not from a marginalized identity, you're like, well, what's the big deal? Like, you know, what's significant? Well, it's significant because Black and brown people are not in as many leadership positions.
Totally.
It's significant because, you know, if we take sport, 1.2% of Black and brown women are represented in the sports governance and leadership piece on boards. And then when you think about the fact that how important, if you're the default, if you're white and you're in spaces that are largely white, you're not necessarily understanding the significance perhaps of why this is so important to marginalized identities. I remember, Lizelle, quick story, I had a conversation with a very conscious white leader, and he was expressing to me, Michelle, what's all the drama? Why is it so important that you know, everyone's talking about Kamala Harris when she became the vice president? Why is that so significant? I said, well, look, let's look at how many Black women of Jamaican and Asian descent have been involved before. Not zero, right?
Zero. I was going to say, you don't have to look far, sadly.
So that in itself then enables Black girls to construct themselves by their own rules. It's like they've been given permission. They're able to see that through Kamala Harris, it's like she's a prism through which they can focus their abilities and their dreams, because they're able to see representation. But when you're part of the mainstream, you're not able to see that. That's not a part of your lens. And so visibility becomes so incredibly important in terms of that representation piece. And then visibility is about owning the success, right? And that's what I'm doing more of in a way that I wasn't doing previously. So when I won the award back in 2016, I received some advice on the night, and somebody said to me, lean into this, Michelle.
Sure,
you tell everybody. And I wasn't going to. I was going to do a gendered response and making a generalization of playing it down. That wasn't going to serve me. So you know what I'm like, Lizelle. I wrote an article. I got it published in various newspapers. I told loads of people about it. And the impact was massive.
Huge. Yeah. And rightfully so, because the impact you had was huge. So the reaction should only be fittingly reflective of that, you know? And I think that's the bit that we sometimes forget, that it's about the magnitude of the impact of what you did. So why wouldn't you want that to reverberate the other way, right?
Yeah, but it was so interesting. It's because it's unseen work. So that, that was such an important accolade, because it was for my difficult conversations that I was having with leaders. It was for the way in which I'd mentored or inspired that particular young leader who's now a leader of a big organization. You know, it's all the work that actually doesn't get any
scene. It's all the things that happen in the background but are so pivotal for what then comes forward and what people then see visibly every day, right? So
it's so visibility, owning success, standing in that light, and it serves to create that space where representation is greater, but it also serves to inspire others.
Definitely. Well, I'm a beneficiary of that, so thank you. And just whilst we are sort of looking to wrap up on this wonderful journey we've gone on, I was really curious to want to ask you this question. I ask all my guests, but I have a little feeling I might know where this will go. When you're looking back and you're there and 50, 60 years time, at least, what is the one thing that you would love to leave behind as your legacy, like the thing that you can be super happy to overhear people say that you gave or you left behind?
I don't know about this question, Liz Ellie. Come on, you know, who are we to talk about legacy? Come on, I'm keeping it real. I'm someone that cares about the world deeply. I'm somebody that wants to live in the fullest expression of who I am and what I'm about. I'm someone that wants to be able to, you know, rinse every opportunity out of this lifetime, in the sense of really kind of living through into my potential. And I want that for others. And in doing that, I'm then enabled to be of service not only to myself, but to those communities in which I'm a part of and which I want to be able to support in some way or other. So legacy, I'm not sure that kind of resonates with me, but being somebody that wants to make my difference, make my family proud, honour the legacy of my grandma from Guyana, my paternal grandma came here, you know, in the 50s on boats with three small children, you know, to think that I'm living a life that I live today with the opportunities that I have is down to her sacrifice, down to her struggle and the oppression that she experienced.
Yeah.
So on my mum's side of the family, they were a family of being in service to others. My granddad was a butler and my dad was a cook. And on my paternal side, my gran was a nurse, and my other granddad, he worked on the trains. And, you know, the people gave. They were of service.
Yeah.
Struggle in their life. Mm. So my job is to make sure I honour their legacy by actually challenging the status quo. By being the, as cliche as it sounds, but by being the best version of Michelle Moore, you know, there's a bit of a Leahism going in there, talking about myself in the third person.
I love that.
A lot of sports people do it, but in a way of saying, look, I know that what I'm about can make a massive difference to others, and I get my joy from that. Like, I get something from that as well. Like, I'm really clear when I'm coaching and mentoring that I love to see people's growth, and I get exhilarated by that, and I recognize that for myself. And I'm always learning, especially from my younger mentees. They're always kind of making me come correct on some level. And so I think for me, the legacy piece is about how you define that, what you see as. You know, it is a personal, response in how you self-determine your life. Like, how am I going to, despite these injustices, despite what people see as these boundaries and these margins, Michelle, when I told people that I had a book deal, I started out with saying, oh, I've got some great news. And some responses that I got were, oh, are you getting married? Having children? And I'm like, no, neither of those things, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's so interesting, isn't it? And I'm like, yeah. Those boundaries are not mine. Those are not when I go into schools and I talk with young people or at universities. I talk about the fact that this is what societal expectations are. Michelle, yeah. Be a CEO. Michelle, we want you to head up this. We want you to be the president of this. And I'm like, that is great for you. Those are your ideals of what convention might say or what you think I should be doing because you see me as this leader. They're not mine. This is how I self-determine my version of success. And that's why actually being involved in strategic, great advisory work, that's working with individuals, that's creating my own innovative programs, that's joyfully talking about real wins on an international stage. Those are the ways in which I narrate my bestseller, right? And I'm in charge of that. That's my journey. And I encourage everybody to go on their journey, to offer their bestsellers in whatever way they see fit.
Yeah, that sounds like a phenomenal place to leave this wonderful conversation. Thank you for the generosity, the great storytelling, the wonderful insights you've given over this. I think 100% you are living your legacy in the great springboard and the lessons and the just sheer inspiration, I think, can't ever be understated, that you give people through living your truth and encouraging them to do the same. So thank you from the bottom of my heart for everything you're doing. Keep shining high, and everybody go read Real Wins. Listen to it on Audible. It's fantastic to have the opportunity to have the story told by Michelle, and also read the book if you prefer, if you're a bit more traditional. But one thing I can guarantee you is that it'll be time well spent. So thank you, Michelle, for your time.
Thank you so much, Lizelle. Thank you for seeing me. Thank you for being you. Thank you for all of the gifts that you share with the world. And I am so happy that we got to do this. It was great. I really enjoyed it. Brilliant, insightful questions. And I loved our conversation from the bottom of my heart. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for joining us for another episode of In Her Corner. I've been with the absolutely brilliant Michelle Moore.